And I got a lot of inspiration for this talk, especially from the folks at Four Kitchens for the structure of how to present this. And in terms of content, a lot of input from Greg Nettison and Jakub Suchy. So I would like to thank them first and foremost. And basically the reason I'm here and I ended up doing this talk is that I became the Drupal 6 maintainer in 2007, and I did not want to get on the security team. But if you are a Drupal core maintainer, you are required to, so there's no choice. Because, of course, there are sometimes security issues that needs to be fixed, so I immediately became a member of the security team, and I'm a member of ever since. And I've seen a lot in these past few years, and I'd like to help you by sharing those experiences so that you can use Drupal better and use Drupal in a better environment to have a more secure site. And to position this talk better, I'm interested in why are you here? If any of you consider yourselves managers who don't care, who don't want to care about the rest, but just the high level, no? Oh, this one there. Okay, that's cool. Site builders who just want to click stuff together. That's good. Very good. Themers, building themes. Okay. Developers, hardcore code. Okay. Good. So then this talk should be pretty good here. There's quite a few developer examples in this talk. I hope that's still useful for those who don't write code. That should be very useful for themers. So if there's one thing that you gather from this talk, that is you should go and buy this book, everybody. It's a very good book, not mine. It's from Greg Nettison. It's called Cracking Drupal, Drop in a Bucket. And if you buy this book and only spend time with chapter 8, I think, then you'll learn a lot on Drupal security. So there's a full chapter in this book that teaches you how to find Drupal sites with security holes and crack into them. Pretty good. So I suggest you read that. I learned a lot from this book. So question is, are you effective? Will anybody go to your site and crack into it and do something? Some people might say, oh, I'm just running a simple block here, whoever. Why would somebody want to crack into this site? And the answer to this is, I think you are, because identities are very powerful on the internet. Many users share the same identity across different sites, so even if they hack into your site and can steal user identities there and use those identities on Facebook or iTunes or whatever else where they can actually use it to spend money on others' behalfs, etc., that's pretty bad. So any website on the internet can be a target. And with relatively simple holes, your administrator user account can be taken over and your website at that point is basically owned by whoever broke into your site. So we'll see how that can happen with a few examples. And the structure I chose for this talk is the OWASP, the Open Web Application Security Project's top 10 list of vulnerabilities, or security risks, rather, that websites face on the internet. And the reason I chose this is because that's an independent list of the top lists, and we can compare how Drupal fares in those areas, and we can see what kind of solutions Drupal has in that area, and it's a very good list to consider if you pitch Drupal for a client or need to talk about Drupal security. You can see how it compares to industry standards. And I will start with number 6 and then go back to the regular numbering order because this is one of the simpler ones that is easy to understand for anybody, and it's called security misconfiguration. And it can happen with your Drupal site and with the environment of your Drupal site. Who heard here about the WordPress.com attack that happened mid-April? A few of you? Okay. So I'm not picking on WordPress here. This attack, actually, that we know of this attack, it has nothing to do with WordPress. So WordPress has a pretty good security track record. And the attack that happened on WordPress.com in mid-April was not due to WordPress vulnerabilities that I know and that I've read. The problem was that they've had unsecure systems running on the servers under WordPress, right? So the web server stack, all the software that runs on the server to make WordPress run, was attacked there. And attackers get access to the servers and the file system, and they could get the source code for the parts of WordPress.com that are not open source, and they could get access to the data of blogs hosted on WordPress.com. And that was not due to WordPress. And the same can happen to any Drupal site, because however secure you make Drupal, if your underlying system is not secure, you are screwed. So you should look at both the underlying system and whatever tools you use to manage your Drupal site and your Drupal site itself to make it secure. So a few things for the underlying system is we've seen in Jen's session that FTP was introduced in the 70s. Was that the 70s? Something. So it's very old. And there's no security thing at all. So it's the ages when anonymous FTP was golden and you can go anywhere and look at anything. And FTP is that from that era. So if you use FTP, your passwords will be easily stolen and anything can happen there. Check your client tools. If you look on the web, there's tools you can download to hack Total Commander password files, for example. So you upload a password file from Total Commander. If you use that tool to log into your servers, then it basically de-encrypts your password file and you can see the passwords in plain text. So look at your tools, whatever you use, and make sure that there is a good security track record with them. If you're using a shared host, anything can run on there, right? So any other software can run on there, from bulletin board systems to forums to PHP, MyAdmin, without security checks there. So a lot of things can run on the server, both on the server level and under there, that needs to be looked at. And of course, your operating system, your PHP version, your SQL server, etc., should be up to date as much as possible. In terms of Drupal, a lot of people don't use very secure Drupal admin passwords, or they don't rotate their admin passwords. So if you use an admin password, and you work with a few developers, and some of them quit, and they are angry at you, and they can log into your customers' sites as admin, that could be a problem. So angry former colleagues could be a pretty big problem. You should look at all the administer permissions, because they are named administer because they are dangerous. So if you grant people administer filters permission, that can be used to take over your site. So anybody who has administer filters permission or administer users permission can basically take over your site. It doesn't look like it. It's not like I'm granting permission for you to do anything, but it can be used in ways. And we'll see a few examples later on what administer filters can achieve. Drupal provides this update module in core that checks for updates of your modules. So similarly to the previous slide where I said you should update your OS, your PHP, or MySQL, if you use update module, it tells you about all the updates to the modules and the themes that you run in Drupal core itself. And the process that we built in the security team is that we do these releases every Wednesdays. So you can go on a holiday from Thursday to Tuesday. You can go and slip drinks on the beach. But on Wednesdays, you should expect that there's something happening that you might want to look at. So this is to have predictability in our schedules, so you can do your QA on Thursday and Friday if you need to do it for your site and you don't need to sacrifice your weekend to roll out a security update there. So we have a security mailing list where we post these announcements. We have an RSS feed where we post these announcements. An update module specifically can send you emails and present you a UI for what updates are available. There's also this nice PHP module in Drupal core that I would suggest you avoid at all cost. It not just let careless administrators to white screen your site, it can also be used to inject any kind of PHP code to your site, which can run fun stuff on your server. So you should write your own modules instead. CHX is working on a tool called, I think, Modulify or Hookify or something like that. Modulate. That looks at these PHP things in the database and it actually generates the module code for them. So if you run PHP module on a site, you can look for this Modulate module and talk to CHX. That would generate the module for you, and you could just use that module or just do some edits to make it more lean and clean and then use that module instead of those PHP inputs and disable PHP module. There's also Paranoia module, which I think is very useful. I run it on many of my sites. It basically hides PHP module, so you cannot even enable it. It hides itself, so you cannot disable it. And it does things like it will not allow you to edit user number one on Drupal 6 or do other kinds of funky things. So it will do some of these don't let users do stuff that you do not allow them type of control. You should watch your input formats. This is very in line with my administrator filter suggestion, and we'll show an example for that. Input formats is a very interesting thing because when you enable people to submit certain things in certain input formats, those have help text. And help text is something that shows on your web page, and help text is something that you can be Googled for. So if you allow certain input formats that are not secure, like full HTML, people can use Google to find Drupal sites that have full HTML for anonymous or for authenticated users, and they can use that to break into the site. And I'll show an example for that soon. And there is the security review module, which checks for some of these and even more criteria to help you ensure that your setup of Drupal is secure. Okay, so that was security configuration. And that was number 6, and I'm back to number 1 now, which is injection in the list of the OWASP list. And there's many different kinds of injections. I will single out SQL injection here because that's pretty interesting. For you coders or anybody who understands this much code, the concept behind SQL injection basically is that some data is coming in from somewhere. In this example, it's coming in from the URL. And that data is used in an SQL query directly. And we just use that without filtering. And what can happen here is that basically any kind of SQL comment can be entered into that ID value. And it goes unchecked into the SQL query. Okay, so SQL injection basically lets users to inject their own chosen SQL comments there in the queries. And the way it works is that we do not filter that data, and we do not ensure that it's in the type that we require there. And this example shows it's coming from the URL, but data can come from anywhere untrusted. It can come from an email you've just parsed from SMTP or a node title that came from your database or wherever else. So you should treat data as untrusted unless you are explicitly sure that it's trusted. What Drupal does to make it trusted is that it lets you separate the data from the SQL query. So you put in placeholders into the SQL query like value and ID, and then it looks at the schema for this table, for this structure, and it converts the data to that type. So it ensures that the number is cast to a number. It can never have an SQL text in there. Or if it's a string, then it is encoded properly in the quotes. If you need to include multiple dynamic database table names or whatever, then the dbsKTable function could be useful there. So basically, the single message here for developers is that whatever data comes in, you should treat as untrusted. If it comes from a node title or anything, it's untrusted. Drupal does not filter stuff in the input. Drupal filters stuff in the output. So treat it as untrusted and use the DB API placeholders to get them casted to the right values and filtered. Second one is much more fun, cross-site scripting, number 2 in the OWASP list. Cross-site scripting, it's abbreviated XSS because CSS was already taken. And it's very similar, but the difference here is that the data that is coming in, we output to the browser. So the data can come in the same way through the uh, through the URL, or it can come from a node title, or from a node body via full HTML access to somebody, or by allowing unsafe tags in some kind of field on the node, or whatever like that. So it comes from somewhere, the data comes from somewhere, and we just print it out to the output. So we just let it go to the browser. Okay? This is a very common mistake. So there's a paper from the Whitehead Security Group that they do a research every year on this, and their latest number is that 64% of 64% is the likelihood that a website has a cross-site scripting issue. So two-thirds of your websites are likely have at least one cross-site scripting issue. And what you can do with cross-site scripting? So as I've said, cross-site scripting is basically data's coming in that's untrusted, either from the node title or from the node body that was full HTML or from the URL or from somewhere else, and we print it out, okay? We print it out to the browser. Now, if you print it out to the browser, it can have any content in it. For example, this little JavaScript code that was made up by Heine Dilstra, the leader for the Drupal security team. This JavaScript code runs on Drupal 5. The reason I did not update it for 6 and 7 is that it would be more code, but it does the same for Drupal 6. So it's a little bit more code for Drupal 6 to make it work, and a bit even more code for Drupal 7 to make it work, but the same concept applies to Drupal 6 and 7. So if you let people enter full HTML content to your node bodies, they can enter this. And what they do here is that they basically request your user one edit page with jQuery, and they register a success function for that, which gets the data in. And if it's successful, then we look for the edit form token that is checked on the server side. We get that token in, and then we send in that this is the user edit form with this token, and we pass in the new password and post that with jQuery. So what happens here is that basically that page is requested and the form is filled in, that's sent in, and it's saved. The only case that this is actually possible to run is if user number one loads a page with this code, right? So if user somebody else loads a page with this code, they probably don't have access to this form. Although if they have administer users permission enabled, then they do. Depends on your permission level. If you're user number one, this code runs, and it changes the user number one password. So one thing that should be on your mind is that hackers usually don't want to destroy your site because that's not valuable to anybody. So script kiddies would destroy your site, but that's not really the value in hacking. The value in hacking is to get data from your site, from your users, from their credit card data, whatever. So the real value is in sneaking into your site and staying around and gathering data, or getting into your site and pulling out your data and run away. So this one lets them sneak in your site, and until you figure out you don't know your user one password, this works. So the thing that allowed this is if you allow full HTML access to someone or administer filters access to someone, that they can grant themselves full HTML access and put this into a node body. Now, for developers, the way to solve this is to use the right functions for the right output. If we assume that HTML is to be output, then Drupal has these rich set of functions to filter your content. There is check URL, which filters the text to only allow URLs, just the URL. There's check plain if you want to have plain text output, and then all the tags and everything will be printed out as tags, and they will not be executed. There's a check markup if you have format information on the node body. There's format information, like if it's markup or BB code or full HTML, then check markup is to be used. If it's if there's no format information but it should be HTML, like in Drupal 6, the site mission or the site footer message was like this, then you use filter XSS. And if you actually already know that this is trusted, then you can output to HTML. Okay? So if you assume it's HTML output, then Drupal has a rich set of functions for you to use. And this is very important for themers as well. So Drupal does prepare a lot of its data for themers already filtered and already ensured that they are trusted. If you look at theme files, on the top of theme files, there are all the variables documented that are pre-filtered for themes. But if you go into like row objects like node and you print out the node title from the node object, then that's not filtered and it's not prepared for you to use in this kind of output. So it's very important for themers to consider this as well and use the theme provided variables if at all possible. But if you need to dive into internal data structures, then you need to use the same code as any developer would use. And for developers, there's also some sneaky functions built into our localization system that secures your site. So if you want to localize a certain text into the site's language or to the current user's language, then you would use the T or the format plural functions. And the T and the format plural functions have these special placeholders that run checkplane for you or run checkplane and do it in the placeholder theming. So I would suggest you check these out. And these are also available in JavaScript as Drupal T and Drupal Format Plural. But not all output is HTML, so you should consider if your output is to an email, then you would totally escape it differently or filter it differently to make it look nicer. Drupal has formatting functions for email that strip out HTML and format it proper for email as well. And there's all kinds of other output that you want to think about, like if you're feeding data to an iPhone app or to a service integration, something, then that might require different escaping rules. So just consider that Drupal has a very rich set of functions for HTML. And if you don't use HTML, then there's other solutions, but you should always concentrate on what kind of output are you looking at. Number three is authentication and sessions. And for that, Drupal has a pretty good set of solutions, mostly built in. So this risk would be about weak password storage and account management, or session hijacking, where people can use your session to use the website, or lack of session timeout, or not logging out users. And what Drupal does for this is we store passwords hashed. That improved a lot in Drupal 7 and was made pluggable. We change session IDs when permissions change. So session hijacking, and I'm not sure a lot of you are familiar with that, is basically about Drupal uses storage on the browser to identify your user when they come back. And that storage has a little key called a session ID, which attackers can pre-fill in links for you. And if users visit those links, then they can predict the session ID that you use to visit the site. So what Drupal does is if you log into the site, it changes your session ID. So whatever an attacker would want to pre-fill in the URL or in the link would be vanished and they would be gone. And we have full control over the user session ID from that point. Drupal works with Apache's SSL layers. There is not much to do there. There's some special modules to help with that, and I will get to that later. But let's get to number four, which is insecure direct object referencies. And that's a pretty funky way to refer to permission checking on stuff. And the example I put here is something I already secured for SQL injection, so this should look pretty good, right? So there's some ID coming in the URL, and I'm saying I select that data from the node table where that's the node ID, and then use that data later on, okay? So it looks pretty secure. There's no SQL injection in here. It's nice, and it works. However, there is no checking in here that the user actually has access to this node, that the user can view this node. So if I just look at the data direct and don't use Drupal's system to check access to that data, then I basically bypass all that security layer and do this and result in insecure object referencies. So what Drupal does for that is we have a menu system that is poorly named. It does a lot of things. So it lets you edit menu items on the UI, but it also handles all the permission checking on the backend. So it has permission checking built in for like the nodes that check for the node permissions. Or if you need to check permissions yourself in your own code, then we have the user access and node access functions that you can specify this, the operation that you want to do, like administer nodes or edit this node. And it checks that permission with that user and gets you the gets you information on whether that user is allowed to do that or not. If you need to build this into a bigger query that you're running, then Drupal 7 has query tagging. So you can query your tag with the node access. You can tag your query with the node access tag. And it will tell the system to put in the node access clauses into the SQL query. And we have Form API, which checks for data validity, and it also checks for whether the form was actually presented to the user before it's submitted. So Drupal has different levels of checking on whether the data that was referenced is actually accessible to be displayed and to be used. Now, a much more fun item is number 5. It's cross-site request forgery, which is CSRF. And it's named cross-site, but it can be used on the same site as well. And the fun example for that in Drupal is this. So that is why Drupal.org does not allow you to post images. This slide, okay? So if a site allows you to post images like this, then you can log everybody out of the site if it runs Drupal. Because user logout does not ask you, okay? So it just logs you out. So if you put this image on somewhere on the Drupal site, then anybody who visits that page will be logged out. And this is a known problem in Drupal, but it's not really a security issue, because if you log out that user, then what you gain by that? You don't gain anything. So the security team is not really focused on like trying to like put in the confirmation page or something. It's like, are you sure you want to log out? But that's how we can protect for this. So let's see a more dangerous example. So let's say if some system would allow for this. So if that system has a delete operation that says delete that content with that ID, and you put this in the image source, then it would delete that item. Anybody used the, before Chrome was released, Google worked on a web speed a plugin for Firefox. Anybody used that? Not much? Okay. So the web speed plugin for Firefox was basically about looking at all the links on the page that you just loaded and prefetching them. So if you click any of them, then it gets right, right in your face. So there, it's already loaded. It's preloading links. And if you go to an admin page that has these kinds of links and it preloads all of them, then all your site content is gone. So that's where some developers realize that, oh, so we need confirmation forms to actually ask users about this. And Drupal was not affected by this because we already had confirmation forms, but some other systems were. So if you think confirmation forms are painful, this is why they are there. So the Drupal way to solve this is that Form API works with post submissions by default. So we don't really allow by default this GET request from an image, but POST requests can be faked with cross-site scripting with JavaScript. So that wouldn't itself solve the problem. Form API also includes form tokens, which means that when a form is generated for the page, we put in a slightly randomly generated token that identifies that form. So when you submit it, we check for whether you actually have seen a form that was submitted. So we require a request before you can submit the form. But again, if you have cross-site scripting issues, you've just seen that you can just read in the token and submit the form with that token. But if you have cross-site scripting, there's nothing to protect you about cross-site request forgery, because all these protections are futile. And Drupal also includes a Drupal valid token function. So GET requests can also use tokens. Then you can put in the token in the link. So when the link is clicked, then the token is checked, and if it's valid, then it can run. And that can be used for this problem when we know the URL exactly and we can make you do this in your browser. It does not really protect you from this when you have a list of links to do stuff. So in that case, if the browser preloads those links and they all have the token, then the server will just run those. So the best solution for this is confirmation forms, that when you submit it, you're required to have post, and we check the form token, and we ask you if you're sure, and if you click sure, then we actually do the action. There are some modules in Drupal, like voting modules, which don't do this, but like make voting or the like button much harder is not really a usable solution. So you need to weigh the gaming aspect and the usability aspect somewhat. Number 7 is insecure cryptographic storage. And for that, I already said that Drupal stores user passwords hashed with a one-way hash. We have a randomly generated a private key on every Drupal site, which is unique to every Drupal site and can be used to encrypt stuff. And we have quite a few modules to encrypt stuff in all kinds of ways. I don't have a direct recommendation here, so you can look on Drupal.org. And one very important notice here is that you should look at your backups. So I've seen people sending backups to themselves by email. They have like big email boxes somewhere that they just get the TarGZ backups by email. So if you don't secure your backups, then whatever you do to secure your website, they can just steal your backup on the way when it goes in the email. And there goes all your data. So you should look at your backups and whether they are stored secure, and whether you can actually restore from them is a different question. It's not really related here, but it's important as well. Number 8 is a failure to restrict URL access. And because Drupal mostly works with objects, I mostly already explained this one in the insecure object references section. So it's the same thing, similar to that. We use the menu system to handle access, and you should continually review those permissions so that the menu system can actually check with the right permissions. The security team has a list of dangerous permissions, and Drupal 7 has a feature where it highlights dangerous permissions with visual cues, so that you can actually stop and think about, okay, so do I really want to grant this permission to someone? So that's good to check. Another very interesting thing, and pretty scary, is number 9, insecure transport protection. And here my question is, who heard of FireSheep? Okay, some of you, that's good. So FireSheep is a Firefox extension, okay? So it's useful for breaking into other users' accounts on all kinds of sites. And it's a Firefox extension any of you can download and install on your Firefox browsers. What it does is that it gives you a sidebar and a button called Start Capturing. And it looks at the traffic on the network, and it captures the data that's going on and tries to identify popular website traffic, and then identifies the users that are using those websites. So I actually have a screenshot lying around here to show you. I tried to set it up here, but I've had issues setting it up. So I will just show you the screenshot. And then what happens is, so this is your Firefox browser, and you get this sidebar with basically all the guys that are Facebooking and Twittering and Googling and all that. And it actually preloads their profile pictures and their names. And if you click on them, it goes to Facebook, and with their login, and they're already logged in, and you can post in their name. Okay? So that's FireSheep. So this is number 9, insecure transport protection. Okay? So why can't this be done? Two things. Okay? One thing, you're on an open Wi-Fi that does not have secure protection, like an internet cafe. Number 2, the website itself does not have transport protection, so it's not running HTTPS, but it's running HTTP. Okay? So if you're on an open Wi-Fi and the websites people are visiting are not secured, then this can happen. Because the network traffic is not secured, because the network is not secured and the traffic going on in the network is not secured, then you can just go in and watch at the traffic and grab these pieces. And the traffic includes that session ID that I talked about earlier that identifies the user on the site. So it already has the session ID there. You don't need the password of the user because the session ID identifies them. So you can just use the data from that request and impersonate that user and do whatever you want in that in the name of that user. Okay, so this is FireSheep. And it's a Firefox plugin. It makes it that simple to do this. And a lot of the websites basically cried out when this was released. And a lot of people thought that this was released by Mozilla or Firefox. It was not. It was a hacker experiment, and it worked out pretty well. So the way to protect this for yourself is to don't go online in an internet cafe, if at all possible. If you do go online in an internet cafe, then go on a VPN or try to do something to secure your connections. And if you can't do that either, then ensure that everything that you do is HTTPS. Although everything that you do is pretty hard to do nowadays, that you have programs running in the background and doing all kinds of requests on your behalf. So what would ideally happen here is that your website would do SSL so that you don't need to care about that. So you can run Drupal on full SSL, but that's pretty expensive. That's something we strive for on Drupal.org as well, but we can't get there because there's a lot of money involved in making such a huge site run on full SSL. So people develop modules called secure pages, and secure pages prevent hijack that solve this problem in a way that you can configure some pages to be enforced to go on SSL. So at least the login pages and the other things go on SSL so your passwords can be stolen directly. That's secure pages. And secure pages prevent hijack is against this FireSheep thing. It puts in a secure cookie on your request that cannot be stolen this way. And basically, if you don't have that secure cookie, it would not allow any of the insecure communication either. So it basically blocks the insecure communication if you don't have the secure cookie sent over. So it kind of tries to mix the two worlds to make it more approachable without that big of a cost there. And there is a blog post on DrupalScout.com about this. It's in the knowledge base. You don't need to write this down. I will post these slides, and they're also pretty easy to access there. And the final thing here is, even if you go SSL, even if it's like HTTPS and everything looks nice and dandy, if you don't use a valid certificate, it's like a home-generated some certificate, then the user is always asked, are you sure you want to visit this website? It has a home-generated certificate thing. And you need to press yes. And if there's a man-in-the-middle attack and they replace your certificate and direct the user to a different server, they will not notice because you always said yes to that stupid question. So if you use a valid certificate, then there is no interaction involved when you visit the site. And if there is an interaction suddenly sometime, then maybe users will be suspicious, although not all users obviously are tech-savvy to understand that, but at least the tech-savvy users will be suspicious. Okay, number 10, unvalidated redirects. It's pretty funny. The first time I had this talk, Drupal was vulnerable to this. that is about basically you have a link, and it looks like it is your site, but it's really not your site because it redirects to somewhere else. And Drupal fixed that in both 6 and 7, so it's not anymore in the active versions. And the way we try to protect against that is we'll link to local paths at all times, if at all possible. And if you do have your own modules that use Drupal GoTo or Pound Redirect, then just look at where the data comes from to those and if they allow full URLs, and you should filter for them so that this kind of issue is never a problem for you. So this was the OWASP top 10. And I only have one more small topic to say here. Now, you've seen that there's a lot of problems that can happen here, and is this really your best way to build your website? Is any open source system secure for this? Well, the answer for that is, I think, as open source is secure. Because it makes people look at your stuff. So the more people look at it, the more chance it that they would probably realize all the security issues that were there. And that's something that I'm always debating with people, is that if a module has a security release on Drupal.org, does it mean that that's a bad module or a better module than it was before? Right? So if the module does not have a security release, then maybe it was not looked at. If it does have a security release, then somebody at least cared about it. So popularity gets more eyes on it. And unfortunately, so there's always more smart people to fix your stuff. My usual saying of Drupal is that that there is no other solution where you have thousands of colleagues around the world working for you while you sleep. And that's unbeatable. I think that's basically unbeatable. But of course, you can say open source is insecure in ways, because people can equally find holes and exploit them before that's actually released or fixed or announced. Some people either directly or inadvertently disclose these holes. That's unfortunate. So it's always a trade-off of the two. And the answer to is Drupal secure is, I think, probably evident, hopefully, from my talk, is that we as the security team want to make it secure, but it's up to you to make it secure. So we want to make the Drupal API secure. We try to educate everybody to use them securely. But if you write your own themes and you don't follow security standards, if you not configure your site proper, then we can help with that. So it's eventually up to you. There's a guide called Writing Secure Code to help with that. And there's the security team to help with educating and getting fixes out. So our goal is basically, as a team of volunteers, is to ensure the best security of Drupal and the thousands of contributed modules, and design the APIs, educate the people, and fix issues when they come in. So first priority for us is to design Drupal to be better secure, then to tell you about that, and then to fix stuff. So it's not like we are running around fixing everything. We try to support Drupal core and all contributed projects, which means we support those that have stable releases. So those who only have development releases like alpha, RC, we don't support by definition. We do not actively looking for vulnerabilities. So when a report comes in, we are the middleman. We manage that with the maintainer of the module and the reporter of the issue, and we try to help with getting the fix out as soon as possible. And we only support the current and one earlier release of core and the country modules for those versions of core. So it's currently 7.x and 6.x. And when 8.x comes out, we stop supporting 6.x. And that's when I get some rest finally. We do have some points of contact. The drupal.org/security page is the announcements page for all kinds of security issues that pop up. We have a reporting issues page that help you in how you can report these issues, what kind of information we're looking for, so it's more effective for our communication. There's a guide on how to report cracked sites, and there's even a groups.drupal.org group to discuss these issues. And you should buy this book. Any questions? Yes. Yes, the security review module that I mentioned earlier is pretty useful to have like a checklist of whether these configuration items are properly set on your site. Yes. Yep. Yes. So if you find the security hole in your own module, you should report it to the security team, like if it was not your own module. You should submit the suggested solution and explain how you think it's exploitable and how you solved it. And then you can work with the security team to review that and put it into the schedule. So one thing that some module maintainers mistakenly do, and we try to talk them out of that, is to, I found the security hole. I need to get the fix out right now, because then otherwise the world's going to end. No. So we try to keep people on schedule with these Wednesday release dates, because it makes it easier for the security team to push out stuff. It makes it easier for users to like have a predictable time when stuff comes in and they need to look in there and they need to update their sites. So if security releases can come any time, then basically you need every Drupal developer person or a company needs to have somebody on call if there is like, oh, there's a security release, I need to put it in right now. So we want to make it more resource optimized for people, both in the security team and especially for users to work with security releases. So you should basically use the regular process and work with the team and release on events day communicated by the security team. And we can help you put out a security announcement and help actually publish the security release that you have. Yes. Yes, so the suggestion was that there's the coder module that includes security reviews, and it can find false positives in your code, but there's rather more false positives than security issues not found. So you can run the coder module on your modules, and that basically checks your source code and looks for security mistakes. And there are certain kinds of mistakes that can be found this way. So it can identify those, and then you can look at that and work on fixing those. Yes. Yes, the question was that there's oftentimes other fixes and improvements and changes included with security releases of the module. And the answer to that is that we realized this mistake for Drupal core, and we fixed that mistake for Drupal core. And a lot of people are very confused about that. So we are, so we fixed that for Drupal core. The way that we fixed that for Drupal core is that we always release two versions of Drupal core at once if there's a security release. So we release one that is just the security fix and nothing else up on top of the previous version of Drupal core, and we release one that is a security fix and all the other bug fixes that happened in the meantime. And that process is available for contributed modules, so we need to make more education among the contributed module developers, and probably for bigger modules we should try to ensure that better, but it's always like some work and some back and forth between the maintainers and the community and the security team to try to ensure this. So we have a process for this. It freaks out a lot of people though. It's like two releases just came out. Why? Did they screw up with the first? Or what's the difference? And we made a nice figure for the release page to actually show like a flow diagram of this is the version and an arrow and this is what's in the next one and an arrow and this is what's in the third one. But we still get a lot of those questions and confusions of why you do this. And we have a discussion of do different versioning for a core, and that's something that would be interesting for contributed modules also. So when it's a security release, should it have like a special dash security name or something like that? And these are still going on, and I don't have a firm deadline on when we're going to implement any of those changes. Question was if that is a 7 thing. No, we've introduced that change for Drupal 6 and 7. I think last US DrupalCon or something. No, it was before Chicago even. I don't know. No, it was in Copenhagen. I think that we decided that we make this process change, and we've introduced that, and we wrote some documentation on that so we can look up the exact date when we introduced that. But basically, the numbering system changes and all that is independent of whether it's 6 or 7 or country or core, because it's all infrastructure on Drupal.org, how we package those, how we number those, how we branch the versions. It's not really Drupal core version dependent. Yeah, it does not continue. So if I would have internet, I would love to load that graph. No. The idea is just imagine that you have Drupal 7.0, and let's say there's a security problem in Drupal 7.0. Then we release 7.1, that is a one-off just security fix on top of 7.0. And we release 7.2 with bug fixes and the security fix as well. And from there, we treat 7.2 as the base version. And the next release would be a security fix on top of 7.2 and the security plus bug fix on top of that. And then we treat the security plus bug fix release again. So the release schedule that we fix now for Drupal core is that we release core versions usually at the last Wednesday of every month. So that's even more predictable than the security schedule. So if there's a security release and the bug fix release, then it's going to be two releases on the last Wednesday of every month. If it's, or not every month, on that month when we find it. If there's just bug fixes, then it might be a bug fix. For Drupal 6, I have not used the last few slots because there's not a lot of bug fixes to include with Drupal 6. But there's going to be a release sometime soon to include bug fixes. So we always release a security update and a security plus bug fix, and then we treat that, and then we move on from there, and then we treat that the base and move on from there. So you have like 2 months or 1 month of time to catch up, which is quite enough for a QA, hopefully. Anything else? I don't want to hold you down because it's already the break. So if there's nothing else, sorry. Yes, the 6, we will support 6 until 8 is released. That's according to the current policy. And 8 is going to be released in 2 or 3 years. Sometime. So, when it's ready, it's 2 or 3 years. Something. Just like a ballpark. So, I have job security. And you can still use Drupal 6. Yes, Drupal 7 is my website uses Drupal 7, so I'm already working on Drupal 8 stuff. So tomorrow I have a talk on what I'm working on for Drupal 8, and what a lot of people here helped me work on Drupal 8. So it's like Drupal 6, 7, and 8, and it's funny. It's okay. So if there's no other questions, then thank you. Have fun.